This is Boston Public Radio. I'm Kara Miller. Stephen Kotler and Andrew Hessel begin their recent Atlantic article with a pretty terrifying scenario. The president of the U.S. is coming to speak at Harvard, and though he might be well insulated by the Secret Service and well protected from guns, there's at least one weapon that is able to enter the hall where he's speaking undetected, a bioweapon. A weapon personalized for him, designed to be largely harmless for everyone else, but one that will lead to his death. It's a scenario that some may think is alarmist, but that biologist and futurist Andrew Hessel and writer Stephen Kotler believe we ignore at our peril. And I'm joined first by Steve Kotler, a contributor to Forbes, who has written for The New York Times, Wired, and is co-author of the book Abundance. Steve Kotler, thanks for being here.
Hi, Kara. How are you?
So let me first ask you before I bring Andrew into this conversation, before you even get into the sciences, you start your story by talking about the power of crowdsourcing and how crowdsourcing has changed not just biology, but so many other industries. What is crowdsourcing and how has it changed our lives in the last few years?
Crowdsourcing, pretty simply, is just putting things out to a larger group of people via the internet. So in the beginning, we did this with t-shirts. Threadless.com said anybody can design t-shirts. We'll put them up on our website, and people can pick and choose the winners, the things that they like most, and they can purchase them. Wikipedia was built through volunteer labor, through crowdsourcing. But this has, you know, gone everywhere at this point. We've built autonomous cars through crowdsourcing. We've crowdsourced the hunt for extraterrestrial life, the folding of proteins. With the new Obama Jobs Act, it's going to change crowdfunding completely, so we can now essentially crowdsource all entrepreneurship and startups. So it's going to radically shape our lives. It's already radically changed our lives, but in the near future, its impact is going to be far greater.
And we've got Andrew Hessel, a faculty member in bioinformatics and biotechnology at Singularity University, also joining us. He is the co-founder of the world's first cooperative biotechnology company. Andrew Hessel, thanks for being here.
Hi, Kara. Thank you.
So we were just talking with Steve Kotler about the importance of crowdsourcing and how that's changed many different industries. What is the role of crowdsourcing in the sciences right now?
Well, in a way, science is a crowdsource effort. It's open research and sharing through publication. So it's really the foundation of scientific discovery. But what we're seeing these days is the emergence of the citizen scientists coming into this arena as well and being empowered. Science is a technological field, but many of us grow up with technologies today. And we're starting to see people become more and more interested in life science.
So what are the upsides of being able to crowdsource a problem in biology?
Well, for one thing, you don't have to necessarily ask permission. We can be quite empowered to start investigating ourselves, for example. And I've seen the appearance of a substantial community called the Quantified Self over the last few years, whose efforts are just to do that, to really start to quantify their lives in health and in disease, really for their own interests. And this is moving more into technical sciences. There's a recent project that I've seen started up that's both crowdsourced and crowdfunded that is doing microbiome profiling, basically looking at all the microbes in and on our bodies. These are powerful projects.
Now, there are also some clear downsides to crowdsourcing, to sending information out there for a lot of people to be able to access. What are those downsides that you worry about?
Well, I take a lot of my cues from what I experienced with information technologies. And really the main thing that I worry about is really the pace of change in some of these technologies. It's going to accelerate. And we don't really have the mechanisms today to track the rate of change in internet technologies. We always seem to be playing a little bit of catch up in those. But now if that type of acceleration starts coming into life science, we might have to think about how we go and literally engage with the scientific community moving forward.
Steve Kotler, in this article in The Atlantic, you sketch out a bit of a frightening scenario to start off with. I talked a little bit about it at the beginning. It takes place at Harvard. Describe that scenario, delve into it for us, and why did you use it to get people's attention here?
Well, we used it to get people's attention here because it's, you know, it's what the near future could very easily look like. The scenario is pretty simple. It's a DNA design competition that pops up online, a crowdsource competition for a new virus, and a Harvard student that we named Samantha gets online and thinks she's buying a new designer drug, a new designer version of ecstasy or whatever, and ends up actually purchasing a bioweapon. And when she basically, you know, takes this drug, she doesn't get high, but she ends up getting a disease that is only communicable to one person, and that's the president of the United States, who's coming to speak at Harvard in the next couple of weeks. So essentially, Samantha gets a cold. The cold starts to spread around campus. That's what everybody gets, is the sniffles. But when the president shows up, this makeshift virus is actually coded to lock onto his DNA. And once it does that, destruction happens from that point on.
And so the idea is that you can create these personalized bioweapons that for Samantha, for her roommates, they're not deadly. I mean, they might, like as you said, it might give them a little bit of a cold or a flu, but they're fine. Really, there's it can be very targeted in terms of who it's dangerous for. Is that right?
It's a better question. It's a better question for Andrew, but in a sense, that's what we're seeing right now in the evolution of cancer drugs. Cancer drugs are becoming more and more personalized. People have discovered that cancer is a very individual disease. So my cancer is not like your cancer, is not like your friend's cancer. And so we're building cancer weapons that target these individual cells. There's no real difference between, in terms of, depends on the cells you target, but there's no real difference between what we're seeing in cancer and the kinds of weapons we're talking about here. Just a little farther down the line.
So Andrew, let me throw it to you then. Is it possible, even now, to create something that for one person is deadly, but for legions of other people it is really pretty harmless?
I would say at the present time that exceeds our capabilities.
Okay.
But we're moving towards that very quickly with the development of personalized medicines for things like cancer. And it's been my own background in cancer that really informed the ideas in this article. I believe you can't have one without the other. And really, we've seen evidence of similar dynamics coming from the internet. The example that we really draw on in this is Stuxnet, where essentially a computer virus meant to be able to spread through a network causes no harm except to one specific target, in this case, a nuclear weapons program. But the rationale, the thinking, the dynamics are actually very straightforward. The technology is advancing very quickly, and put the one and the other together, and this becomes a scenario that, while we haven't seen it appear yet, is within reach.
And we'll come back to that idea of computer hacking as a model for what could happen here. But it is an interesting other side of the coin where, you know, you talk about the importance of realizing that, let's say, a bunch of people get breast cancer, but it isn't because they all have the same gene. It isn't all, because they have the same genetic code. It's really they get breast cancer for a variety of different reasons. So treating them may take a variety of different medicines. So the very thing that can be so helpful for you in treating a disease you have can also, Andrew Hessel, be on the other side really dangerous.
Well, I see this as a possibility, but I want to be very clear that I see the positives in the development of this technology as very clearly. We need these technologies. They will make a dramatic difference in the way we treat cancers and rare diseases, et cetera. But I think we have to be aware that not every person will look at these technologies and see altruistic purposes. I think we always have to look at the darker side of some of what we're developing and do these exercises where we can, you know, think of mitigations or how we might monitor for anomalies.
Is your sense that researchers, biological researchers in the military, in intelligence services, both in this country and around the world, are working on the issue of bioweapons right now?
I have no deep experience in the bioweapons community, but I believe that bioweapons programs have been reported in the literature, a number of them in different countries. I've seen figures that estimate somewhere between 50 and 60 million $1 billion going into U.S. Bioweapons programs on the defensive side since 9/11. I have no access to how that money was spent or where it's going, but I have to assume that some of the monies and some programs are looking at the mechanisms of certainly involved in how to target cells more specifically and how to kill them.
I'm Kara Miller. This is WGBH, and we're talking with Andrew Hessel and Steve Kotler, who are co-authors of an article in The Atlantic, Hacking the President's DNA. And Steve Kotler, you quote author Ronald Kessler, who has written a lot about the Secret Service, and he says even now there are basically people who follow behind President Barack Obama and collect the things that he touches. Why do they do that?
Well, they do it because DNA is an extremely persistent molecule, and if you can get your hands on DNA, living cells are significantly better than dead cells, and it's harder to get living cells. But you know, it's everywhere and everything the president touches. So they've been, you know, what Ronald Kessler told us is that Navy stewards have been gathering bed sheets, drinking glasses, and things along those lines that are sanitized or destroyed. This shouldn't, you know, be surprising. In 2010, WikiLeaks published a secret cable that Hillary Clinton put out that asked our embassies overseas to surreptitiously collect DNA from foreign heads of state and other senior UN officials. So, you know, we're doing this as well, and it'd be naive to believe that other countries aren't doing it as well.
Is Kessler, since did you get a sense from him that this is something new? When did this start? That as you said, sort of naval officers are following behind and picking up the president's sheets and drinking glasses and all sorts of things he touches.
It is new, from my understanding, and this was something that was vague. The Secret Service would not confirm or deny this. There are reports, there are contradictory reports that came out all over the place. So, getting a really clear answer from the Protective Services on this one was very, very difficult. So we're going from what Ronald Kessler said on this one because he spent considerable time with the Secret Service.
Right. Andrew Hessel, is it possible that, you know, we talked about the real potential upsides for personalized medicine, so biosolutions rather than bioterrorism. Is it possible that there are downsides to this personalized medicine for more of us than just the president? We understand that he could be a potential target, but is it a broader threat to more people than just him?
I think so, but in the short term, I don't see it as being biological attacks. Where I see the immediate threat is really we shed genomic information wherever we go. It's very easy to collect, and it's becoming very easy and inexpensive to sequence in great detail. There are already companies that sequence DNA or sample it at very low cost, a few hundred dollars, giving quite sophisticated profiles of an individual based on their DNA that's been collected. And the resolution keeps going keeps increasing on this. So we're already at about a $1,000 complete genome price point plus analysis. Extrapolate this just a little bit and you see genomes come in under $100. There's so much information in a human genome about potential disease traits, phenotypic traits, what you look like, different features. This is very private information. And yet we shed it everywhere. And I don't think we've really examined the issues of privacy very well or how this information could be used against an individual in their workplace, in insurance, in really just pointing out some of the disease markers they might have. So that's information warfare or threats is in some ways the short-term risk.
You know, and you talk about this biologist, really interesting but sort of scary story at Stony Brook University, who in 2002, it seems like without too much trouble, recreated the polio genome, basically using mail order DNA. And one of the things you point out is, and as you were just doing, that this becomes cheaper all the time. The ability to do this, to recreate whatever it is, different diseases, becomes a factor of 10 easier all the time.
Yeah, we've seen, in fact, I believe the fastest evolving technology really has been genome sequencing, the ability to read DNA. It's fallen from $1 billion or more in 2000 to literally under $1,000 today. But I think most people don't appreciate that we're also getting a newfound ability to write DNA. And it's we still pay per base pair, per character, per bit, really. And it's expensive, which means you can only write small things. But the smallest genomes are those of viruses. And those and viruses are essentially small software programs. They're not fully living entities. They need a host cell to activate, just like an app needs a computer or a mobile phone to operate. So it's been 10 years since the proof of concept was done that a synthetic virus can be made directly from an electronic file, turned, printed, and assembled, and booted up, essentially. That cost is falling every day. So we can see in the future, and I see this as a positive for cancer work, being able to make personalized viral therapies for a few dollars. But the flip side of that is viral engineering technology becomes within reach of almost everyone.
And Steve Kotler, we were talking about crowdsourcing at the beginning, and I know you've written recently about a new DNA laser printer. So, which is kind of amazing, something that prints DNA. And this is, in a way, a new era in democratizing biology and synthesis.
It is absolutely a new era. I mean, the thing to remember is that, Moore's law, which shows exponential growth in computers, right? It says the number of computer chips on an integrated circuit double every 24 months for the same cost. And that's kind of been the baseline of exponentials. And it's the reason why the kind of cell phone in your pocket is, a million times faster and 1,000 times cheaper than a supercomputer from the 1970s. You actually have to reverse that. I got that backwards. But right now, biotechnology is advancing at 5 times the speed of Moore's law. So that's what we're looking at in terms of, the rate of acceleration. It's considerable.
Yeah, and you even say in the article the cost of sequencing any human genome was $300 million a few years ago. Now it's about a couple thousand, and you guys think it's going to be much less than 1,000 pretty soon, 5-10 years.
It's not even that. I mean, that's only one component here. You have to kind of realize that at the same time, all the equipment that is being used is also, A, it's dropping in price, B, with, the resale market on available now on eBay. Andrew has repeatedly pointed out that a $1 million lab from 10 years ago can be had for $10,000 used on eBay. And, you've got examples with, coming out of MIT, the iGEM competition, where you've got high school and college students who are producing, you know, real world biopharmaceutical results. That's how powerful the technology has gotten, and this technology is now accessible to anyone because it's so cheap.
Right, and you have a great quote from Bill Gates, right, of course, founder of Microsoft, who said not too long ago that if he were a kid today, he would not be hacking computers. He'd be hacking biology. And I wonder, Steve Kotler, why do you think he would have made that kind of shift if he were a kid today?
Once you get into what Andrew just mentioned, which is, you know, DNA that's writable, there's really no difference. You're dealing with ones and zeros. You're just kind of programming life forms instead of programming computers. And life can do far, far, far more interesting things and far more potent things.
And Andrew Hessel, you also talk about how Craig Venter, who is became very famous as part of sequencing the human genome and was standing right there with President Clinton, he essentially has done all these really groundbreaking things. One of the things he did is basically dumped his DNA into a host bacteria cell. And I wonder, what are the implications of these new ways of engineering life?
Well, Craig actually did something different. He chemically synthesized the first bacterial genome, in other words, the complete program for a free living organism.
Right.
And he demonstrated that it could be booted up and, in fact, you know, really created the first semi-synthetic life form. That's a remarkable achievement. That's the first time we've really programmed a synthetic life form, and now we have complete control over which base pairs exist in the genome. So that's remarkable. That technology, though, is dropping dramatically in price, and I believe within 10 years in high school classes, there will be build your bug programs. The cost of engineering a small bacterial genome today is a few $100,000. Again, if we're seeing five-fold reductions in price per year, you can do the math. It gets pretty cheap.
Probably the reason that Bill Gates would want to get into biology today, potentially, rather than computers.
I think it's really the most powerful and exciting technology, and like computers, like the internet, used appropriately, is transformative for the positive globally. But we always have to be aware, as with computers, that there will be vulnerabilities, there will be attacks, and I think it's time that we start revisiting really the architectures that we've got in place today in life science, in regulatory, to start keeping pace with some of the changes. Our systems, our regulatory systems are still built for an age where biology didn't advance this quickly, wasn't accessible to so many different communities. And if anything, I hope this article stimulates discussion, stimulates investment in new technologies, and really grows interest in programming living things.
You know, you talk about not just bioterror, but also bioerror. And when I read some of the stuff that, let's say, Craig Venter's company is working with ExxonMobil on a new designer algae, or DuPont is working on an organism that eats corn sugar and basically excretes a common chemical in consumer goods that they can use. And it's a chemical that's in cosmetics, it's in antifreeze, it's in paint. Are you worried at all, not just about people who have really bad intentions, but about the creation of new organisms that, who knows if they are let out of the lab, what they do in the real world?
Well, I want to give credit where credit's due. It's a group called the Etcetera Group that kind of acts like the Greenpeace of synthetic biology that started raising the ideas of bioerror and has really drawn some attention to the potential risks in this area. And I think that's fantastic for stimulating discussion. I strongly advocate that genetic engineering is done with and used in closed systems. I think we really need to have a lot of safeguards before we start putting it into the open environment. And in general, most of the programs working in synthetic biology are designed, are laboratory-based systems. The real world is filled with microorganisms and viruses and bacteria of all shapes and sizes. As deep a hole as we've ever drilled in the earth, we found bacteria, and bacteria live in clouds. So really, anything that got released from the lab is going to have an uphill battle trying to find a niche. But that being said, we have people that really like to hack systems, and a few people take pleasure in causing harm. And so there are vulnerabilities in the human operating system that can be exploited. And certainly the agents that do that, bacteria and viruses, have the smallest genomes and thus the easiest to engineer. So I think we have to start looking at the interface between the virtual designs and the real world, and we've done some of that. But I think we also have to look out for people that are using and accessing genomic data and these tools in ways that appear to be malicious.
And Steve Kotler, Andrew Hessel mentioned Stuxnet, which was this virus that affected Iranian military computers, seemed to set their nuclear program back a little bit. And I wonder, how good do you think both states are and criminal organizations are at adopting new technology and using it for their ends, whether it's computers or biology?
Well, that's what one of the trajectories we were following in this article is the kind of development of, the criminal element in kind of information technology and computers. As soon as there is a new technology, criminals very, very quickly, find ways to hack it. And, it goes on and on and on. It started with, phone freaks back in the 70s, which, gave us Apple computers. Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak started out that way a little bit and were part of a group that played that way. But, it's gone all the way up to, we've hacked supposedly uncrackable, credit card algorithms and on and on and on. So, what you see on the computer side of this is as soon as a new technology gets introduced, people start figuring out how to use it for kind of malicious purposes, or in the beginning possibly for fun, just to try to hack it, and then, for criminal enterprise. And there's absolutely no reason to believe that we won't see the same thing in the biosciences.
Even organized crime has been getting in on the act here, using computer hacking to make money, to figure out ways of getting into systems, that kind of thing.
Well, you brought up crowdsourcing at the beginning of our discussion,
yeah.
And you're even seeing some of the Asian gangs have taken to crowdsourcing murder.
Wow, how do you do that?
There was that Facebook example, but I'm not great on the details on that, so I'm not going to talk about that. But they put out contract hits. The Japanese gangs have contracted out to Chinese gangs via kind of crowdsource sites.
I
as
see.
As far as we know.
And you also have written about, pretty recently, about 3D printing and how the proliferation, the power now to actually buy a 3D printer could revolutionize crime. I wonder how you see that working.
Well, it's the same kind of thing. 3D printing democratizes manufacturing. It's an incredibly potent technology. But we saw, I believe it was a couple months ago now, somebody printed the first kind of semi-automatic weapon, and it fired just fine.
Wow.
So suddenly arms dealing, which is an extremely lucrative criminal enterprise, suddenly becomes something that you can, at least when it comes to guns, you can now use a 3D printer to print them. That those technologies are only going to increase as we go along in power. So it's really, in a weird way, if you look at the three kind of largest criminal activities, which are exotic animals, arms, and drugs, we are now getting to the point where we can 3D print, with the first DNA laser printer, as you pointed out, we're starting to be able to 3D print all three of these things. So what it's going to do, moving out into the far future, is, you know, in a sense, democratize criminal activity. I don't know what it's going to mean for the crime syndicates of the world, but it's certainly going to be a threat, you know, in a weird way. And they don't tend to react to threats very positively, so it's going to be very interesting. But it really does, you know, these are amazingly powerful, wonderful technologies that are going to do great amounts of good for society, but they put a lot of hands in the power of individuals. And, you know, you're going to have a couple of people who are malicious, and it's concerning.
I'm Kara Miller. This is WGBH Boston Public Radio, and we're talking with Andrew Hessel from Singularity University and Steve Kotler, a contributor to Forbes. He has written for the New York Times Magazine and Wired about their recent article in The Atlantic about bioweapons. And Andrew Hessel, let me come back to you and ask about some of the protection and precautions that we're taking. And one of the things that was in the article that scared me a little bit was you talk about perfectly legitimate institution, the Beijing Genomics Institute. It says it sequences about 700,000 human genomes a year. But one of the things you say is, well, the researchers who work there, very often really talented people, are not paid that well. So what is the potential in a huge organization like that? And we've already seen this happen in other industries for somebody, let's say Iran, North Korea, Pakistan, to say, hey, you know, to one person, here's a bunch of money. If you could give us this or that, you know, we could give you a great retirement right now.
Well, you know, you're talking simple economics and ambitions. Really, I want to give credit to BGI because they've advanced sequencing technology and just and accelerated it just through brute force. That being said, the turnover in places like BGI will happen. We'll see it across the world. Just as people get trained in genomics, they'll move on to different careers. We'll see a lot of cross-fertilization. And I believe that biology becomes the next IT industry, fueling economic growth globally for decades to come. So I don't think everyone's going to stay in that job. I think there'll be a lot of cross-fertilization. And yes, I think there's the potential for a small number of individuals to be pulled into darker programs. But where, you know, whether that directly increases risk, I don't know. And I think that in the short term, we also see a lot of people starting to revision biosecurity and biodetection, just being able to track infectious agents through the world. And that's a tremendous opportunity for sensor developers and information system developers. We haven't seen that layer of enhanced essentially detection starting to pop up yet, but I think it'll be significant and it'll change the way we think of things like epidemiological monitoring. These are positives.
And even biosecurity in the U.S. encounters some of those, what you said is essentially a financial or economic issue where if you're the FBI or you're the Secret Service and you're trying to get the very best people to work for you, you're competing with academia and you're competing with industry. Is that a fight that the Secret Service and the FBI are winning?
I don't know. They have large staffs, and I'm sure they pay federal wages. I don't know if they can pay the top dollar that a pharma company would. They tend to have, you know, plenty of collaborations. But we know this. We know that most of the experts, Bill Joy, I think, famously said it, that most of the experts are not within your own company or organization. They're outside of those walls. And so really part of why we believe in the power of crowdsourcing some of the these technologies is because we need larger communities and more diverse thinking and experts coming together. Not only do they really create new technical communities that are capable, very passion-driven, it's not about salaries, they're generally just incredibly interested in these technologies. We also get peer groups and community groups that are globally networked and dispersed. The more we know about these technologies, the less we'll fear them. It's similar with computers. And I think in the short term, it's our fear of the technologies that kind of hold us back. And I believe you can either be afraid of it at the back of the pack, or you can be afraid of it and lead the pack and really truly understand the nature of the challenges, but also get the benefits from the economies, jobs, etc.
Now, do you worry that America is not at the front of the pack, or do you think we are in terms of coming up with the new ideas? And
I think we're at the very front of the pack when it comes to the technology development, the training. The training is globally dispersed. Biotechnologies are everywhere. My main concern is the translation of new breakthroughs into the marketplace, and then where you can start to generate economy. That's usually that's an onerous process in the West. I'm not sure how it is in every country, but I know that as the technologies get cheaper and there's less regulation, there's less monitoring, there's the opportunity for people to make things and just release them because, or use them because there's need or they see some economic value for doing it. So like the internet, I think that there's the potential that these race ahead faster than the regulatory agencies can keep up. And we'll get a few surprises and a bit of chop. I don't think it'll be all that serious in terms of accidents, etc. But, you know, you can't predict the future.
And Steve Kotler, let's look ahead to that future, a very near future. There are huge precautions, you say in the article, for President Obama's inauguration in January of 2013, his second inauguration. What is your sense of the precautions that are being taken, and is it going to be enough?
I am absolutely not an expert on presidential security, so I can't really speak to what preparations are going to be taken for his inauguration. But, you know, the FBI has looked very, very hard at kind of synthetic biology. Of the agencies that we know about, they've really tried to stay at the forefront of it. And the point they make is the only way they could do it was to essentially open source the problem and bring in top researchers to help them work the problem. And they're really trying to network into the SynBio community because that's the only thing, you know, you can really do. There's no real way to stay on top of it. The information is too diffuse. It's all over the place at this point. So I'm not... You know, I don't think, first of all, I don't think we're obviously looking at the kind of scenario we're describing here. I don't think this is an issue in the coming inauguration at all. Maybe it is, but I don't think it is. But, you know, trying to keep up with it is difficult.
And Andrew Hessel, do you worry about the future as we sort of look ahead to this inauguration? But, of course, inaugurations every 4 years down the line.
I don't think an inauguration would be the right place to release a bioweapon personally. You know, we're talking about a very specific and targeted use that would allow you to do this in a way that wouldn't draw a lot of attention. You know, there's many different threats to any individual, especially when public and visible as the president. All we wanted to do here was draw attention that if there is a high value target, there are new low cost technologies and ways to explore their removal or harm with that may not yet be detectable by or even watched for by security agencies. So we're really just trying to shine a spotlight on. Really, that the technologies are getting ahead of the monitoring, and use the example of having a high value target as really an impetus for starting to think, well, how would you protect a key individual from these types of threats? Because essentially, we're all at risk from the next flu bug that happens to be spreading through the world. So why not start thinking about how to make these technologies, get them out into the world, and then we can start thinking about making them cheaper and looking at colds, flus, and other infectious agents in real time.
Right, a new era of biology and technology. We've been talking about bioterrorism and what it means if we fail to think of this as a viable threat. I've been speaking with futurist Andrew Hessel and writer Stephen Kotler. Together, they are the authors of Hacking the President's DNA in the Atlantic. Andrew Hessel and Stephen Kotler, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Kara.
Thank you.
And Callie Crossley is back in Studio 3.
Kara, as you know, some banks have been described as too big to fail. We're going to look at something completely different, and that's private concierge banking, the new money managing frontier, which is booming in Boston.
That'll be fascinating. Mm-hmm. I'm Kara Miller.
I'm Callie Crossley, and this is Boston Public Radio.
Intelligent, but not yet equivalent.